So given that this is a Blackboard presentation, I thought I'd try to stick to the analytics side. I should say I was hoping my 8-year-old son would be captaining our soccer team. His team won at Saturday morning. We had to get there at 6:45 a.m. But he has an ear infection, and the only reason I'm able to be here is because Michael's partner is watching my son, so I could sneak in here for a little while. So, what I want to start with is how we characterize friction. We typically have two objects pushed together, and we apply some lateral force, and the things that people report are typically the static friction, which is the force needed to initiate motion. When you teach freshmen physics, it's always very confusing to people that the static friction is not really a force, but rather a threshold. You can't just say that there's a force resisting motion equal to this, or you get accelerations all the time. And then there's a kinetic friction, which depends upon the velocity, which is force that's needed to maintain sliding at some velocity. Now, the laws of, so we can think of drawing, say, the force as a function of velocity, and typically you would get a static friction, so you'd increase the force to here and still see zero motion, and then out here you'd typically see some dependence on the velocity. Normally it's logarithmic, which makes it a little tricky to draw with zero here, but anyway, we'll neglect that minor problem. So Amundsen's, about 300 years ago, said that both of these things were...
intercept of that f of v, f of 0 is not f of f.
No. No. And that leads to a lot of interesting dynamical instabilities like stick-slip friction, which gives us the sound of violins and squeak of hinges. But I probably won't have too much time to talk about that. Typically, the kinetic friction is about 80% of the static friction at typical measurement velocities. It does vary logarithmically, so...
elementary textbooks like Halliday and Resnik always have it linear in V. That's wrong.
Or independent of V is the most common. In fact, that is wrong. It doesn't always go up the way I've drawn it. Sometimes it goes down. but the log V is typical. And the fact that it's independent of velocity is one of the three laws of friction. It's due to Coulomb, but of course it's, like any of these, not a true law, because there are exceptions. The Amundsen's said that both of these are proportional to the load and independent of the area of the surfaces. And he did a number of experiments to show this. He also found that the constant of proportionality had a universal value. I can't remember if it was a third or a quarter. There was someone later on who said it was the other one. And just to put that universality in perspective, all of his measurements were made with the materials coated with pork fat, because otherwise he couldn't get reproducible results. So the universality was clearly due to the pork fat as opposed to... So really, there should be a little caveat. This is true if you have pork fat. but this is what we teach, and I think the reason we teach this law that this is independent of velocity and we teach force proportional to load is it's really good for freshman physics problems. And if you incorporate anything real, then it gets hard. And so people grow up thinking this is all there is to friction just because it's all you can teach a freshman. Okay, so if this is true, you can summarize that by saying that there's some coefficient of friction, which is the force over load. Euler is the one to coin mu for that ratio. And this is, again, the thing that would normally be quoted. Coulomb realized that more generally, there is another term here, that in general, you can't just say that the area is irrelevant. And there happens to be a nice little demo of that. I didn't know this would be here, but I have a piece of tape. And obviously, there is friction. The thing is not falling down. There is no load. Okay? And you can try to correct for that by saying, well, there's an adhesive component, an extra effective internal force pulling things in that acts like this load. But in general, you find even when you pull the tape off, so you're at negative load, you can have friction. And so that's... And Coulomb clearly knew about this exception, but you'll find periodically in Physical Review letters someone rediscovering this idea of friction at negative load, always for the first time.
Coulomb also had velocity dependence measurements.
Over a small range.
He thought it was linear velocity.
It's always quoted as being independent. I haven't looked at the original articles, but. Okay. So anyway, the question is, where does this come from? How can we try to understand what we see at the macroscopic scale? And the earliest idea that people had, this goes back to Parent and Coulomb and Euler and all Amundsen all sort of recognized this idea. And that's that if we happen to have surfaces, and at the time surfaces tended to be very rough, if we imagine that the rough surfaces can lock in exactly this way, then if we want to pull the top surface over the bottom surface, well, we have to do a freshman physics project problem. We have to apply a force which just counterbalances the normal load, and you find that this is equal to the load times the tangent of theta, where this theta is the angle of that surface. And one has mu somewhere between 0 and infinity, and thereby has explained all experimental data. And like a good theorist, you can declare the problem solved. The problem, there are many problems with this. At the time of Amundsen and Coulomb, most surfaces were so rough that when you smoothed them by polishing, the friction would go down, which was consistent with this idea. However, if you go to really, really smooth surfaces, the friction actually starts to go up again. And that's due to this adhesive component in the friction contribution. So this clearly isn't the whole story.
Excuse me.
Yeah?
Even in this very simple model, when I was a student, I always wonder about this. If you pull it up on the hill, and then what about when it goes down?
Ah, you beat me to it. That is the fundamental problem. I could raise many other problems, but the biggest problem with this is there's no kinetic friction. That is, the time average force is zero, because you just move up and down, and it's hard to go uphill, but then when you go downhill, you'd get all the energy back. And this was actually realized for the first time by John Leslie during the Civil War. Of this country, and he said, you know, this is sort of like Sisyphus. You know, the fact that we always have kinetic friction is like we're always climbing uphill without ever getting any higher. We're always going up the slope forever, and so this is one of the puzzles and one of the clear problems with this. Now, so let's see. What we can try to do to look at this problem of two rigid solids sliding over each other and see whether it's really very likely that this should happen. This is clearly a special case that I've drawn where they happen to have the same period. And we can look at a a generic surface characterized by some height, where this would be the average height, and then there'd be some roughness superimposed on top of that. And I'm going to imagine that this solid is rigid, but that I can displace it laterally. And then, of course, the height is only going to depend upon the distance from that center of mass coordinate of the top plane, top solid. And now I'm going to have some other surface down here. And here I'm going to suppose that the average height is zero. Oops. And that's stationary. And so I want to ask, when I push down on the top surface, will there be a barrier to sliding over the bottom surface for some generic random shape? Now, in order to do that, I'm going to need to specify some law of interaction between the surfaces, and it turns out that if I assume an exponential interaction that's purely repulsive, then I can actually do something. And that's not necessarily going to be an exact description of any real material, but many repulsive potentials have been fit with an exponential form. And so let's just go ahead and write the potential energy, which is going to depend upon both the height, which I imagine I can control, and the lateral displacement of the top wall. It's rigid, so there's no internal degrees of freedom. And if the exponential interaction is characterized by some energy scale, epsilon, then if I just integrate over the plane, the exponential of the height difference that would be my potential energy of the two surfaces. And C here would just be the decay length of my exponential potential. So because of the exponential form, we can actually simplify this. We can rewrite it just as epsilon times the area times the exponent of minus zt plus delta zt over c. I've used the fact here that I can factor the exponential and just pull that out. And now this delta zt is going to have a bunch of stuff hidden in it. The exponent of minus delta zt over c has to be 1 over the area times the integral of this difference in height . So all I've done really here is to point out that things have to enter in a very simple way, that we just have the average height and then the effective roughness, which is defined by this expression. Now, the frictional force is just going to be given, say, the force in the x direction would just be the partial with respect to the x component of the top of this potential. And the load, the normal force, will just be the derivative with respect to the normal displacement of the top. And because of the simple form we've assumed, if you take the force over the load, you find almost everything cancels out, right? When you take the derivative, here you're just going to get minus 1 over c when you look at the load, and for the other you're just going to get the derivative of delta z. So in fact, the force over the load ends up just being the partial with respect to the lateral translation of this effective roughness of the top. And so the gravitational force pushing down would just be balanced by this internal normal force. Okay, so this would be the force from this balancing that gravitational load. Okay, so this is the friction coefficient, and we've been able to this is just some number. We can take its derivative. There's no dimensions in here, and so we've proved that the friction is proportional to load. We can define the static coefficient of friction is just the maximum value of this derivative. That's like the maximum slope on some effective surface, right? So this delta z is now an effective surface like this that we have to pull the ramp up over, and we can by analogy get force proportional to load, and we get a nice simple result. Now this would indicate that you can understand for Amundsen's laws for any surfaces simply from this rigid point of view. And that's because we haven't gone far enough yet. Because if we actually look, it turns out that delta z is generically zero. And that's not a very helpful result. So in order to illustrate that, we can look at this expression just to lowest order. Just make a cumulon expansion to lowest order. And when you expand the exponentials, you're going to get that delta z is going to be basically the average of the square of this quantity. And the terms that are involve delta zt squared and delta zb squared, those don't depend upon the lateral translation. Okay, so they won't contribute to this. So the only thing that contributes to the friction coefficient is the cross term. And you end up finding to lowest order that delta z, that mu is equal to the maximum of you get a 1 over c. We're going to have this squared. We only have 1 power on that side, so we get a 1 over c, and we get an integral over x of the spatial derivative of delta zt times delta ZB, everything else just vanishes. Delta ZT squared term would have an explicit dependent on XT, but because I'm integrating over the whole area, it drops out in that case. So it's only this term where the difference enters that remains.
It seems to me that this result depends on quite a lot on assumed exponential forms, right? How universal is it?
So so the specifics of what I'm showing you here clearly depend upon the exponential form. Numerical calculations done with Morse potentials, Lennard-Jones potentials, embedded atom potentials, and many other forms all give the same result numerically that you get from this simple calculation. Okay?
The justification of the exponential form is just that it factors nicely.
Yes. Yeah. And this is something, it's a trick that's commonly used to try to include steric effects in things like liquid crystals, because you can integrate everything out analytically.
If you're doing this pure expansion, it wouldn't matter. You could do it in general.
Yeah, but some of the other previous stuff would have been harder. So, yeah, you could work harder, but the simulations bear out this simple thing. Yeah?
I'm just trying to put this in perspective to what I know. And I'm wondering, by assuming that the materials are rigid...
Let me get to that next, if I might, okay? So I'm going to sort of try to make things more sophisticated as we go, and I want to talk about elasticity in a moment. So...
Actually, I was wondering...
Yeah?
Such a large stress on it that it will actually plastically flow.
That is one view of what happens, which is manifestly not correct in some cases that I can point you to, and manifestly correct in others, but that I need to get to later. Okay. So we have this result, which I can, using an expansion in Fourier components, just write the integral over all space can also be expressed as the sum over all Fourier components of so this is just the usual equality between sum and real and reciprocal space. And now you see that what's essential in order to get a non-zero mu s is you have to have common periodicity within this roughness. If you don't have common periodicity, they can't lock, as in that sketch, and you'll get nothing. Okay? So...
Does that define length A? You introduce this A as being some sort of length?
A. Oh, area. This is the area of the surface, sorry.
Is there some... does it have to be a certain size or relative to what wavelengths you're going to consider?
Yes. Let me talk about scaling with the size in just a sec. So, the conclusions... The first conclusion is that you're going to get a big friction when the surfaces have the same period. And basically, in that case, you have the Bragg components of these height functions interfering constructively or destructively, and you get a force which ends up being large and independent of area. And you can, if you just imagine, for example, closed-packed spheres and making a bumpy surface with closed-packed spheres, they would have the same spacing. That would be an ideal sort of three-dimensional example of interlocking surfaces. And Bellador in 1767 or something pointed out that gave you 0.35 for mu, and this was at a time when people were debating whether you had a quarter or a third is the exact result, and so that was was evidence for the one-third idea. But you get numbers of that order if you have simple identical surfaces that interlock in that simple way. Yeah? Which you never do.
One surface had, just 1K.
Yeah?
The other had 2K.
Yeah?
So it was fitted twice.
Yes?
So that presumably comes from the higher frequency?
No, you even if you have something which has I would just assume that if I have a fundamental period, say, suppose we have have p periods of the bottom surface equal to q of the top surface. So we have some sort of rational relationship between the two. Okay, then yes, you have to, if it's perfect sine waves, you'd have to go to higher order in the cumulant. Now, oftentimes the shape of the potential is not purely sinusoidal; it would have other harmonic content. So you would get, in general, the pth period or the pth Fourier component interacting with the qth. And it turns out if you look at the Fourier components of the potential of a rough surface, they tend to decay exponentially as you go to higher and higher powers. So typically, if you actually evaluate the Fourier components, you find they drop exponentially as you go to big P and big Q. So this gives you a very small force, unless you have really P equal Q equal 1. Okay? And for that reason, people routinely do simulations, as we've done, with P equal 12 and Q equal 13, and the force from this kind of effect is 10 to the minus 9th or something. It's completely unmeasurable. Okay? So this... you normally don't get much friction from this this type of approach. And in the case where you have incommensurate surfaces, where there is no common period, then mu s goes to zero as the area goes to infinity, and in this case there are edge effects that give you a component that drops as a to the minus 1/2 or faster. It depends upon the exact details of how you do the cutting at the boundary. You can make it go much faster, even exponentially, or you can have it its scale in that way in the worst case. And you get a similar scaling if you look at random surfaces. And this is, and by this I'm thinking in terms of surfaces that are, say, disordered but approximately flat. So, for instance, if I took an amorphous material and I just sliced it off with a plane that was mathematically flat, there'd still be some residual roughness. There would be disorder, and the Fourier component in plane would have just random Fourier components. And we know in that case that things with they would have random phases, and when you add things in random phase, it grows like the square root, but you're dividing by the area, so you get this 1 over square root. And you can go and make surfaces, as I described, with amorphous structure just sliced. And most of what I've talked about today is in a paper that we had in PRL in actually 2001, where we show some data, numerical data, that verifies all these things work for more realistic potentials than the simple exponent. So we have this problem. It looked wonderful. We had friction proportional to load in all cases. It's just when the proportionality constant is zero, that doesn't agree with experiment. And we have to be in this special case where either things are, by chance, the same structure exactly, which is not likely to happen, or we could imagine that we have surfaces that are rough enough that even though things should average out to zero, the contacts are so small that you don't get too much averaging out to zero. And that's something that for self-affine fractal surfaces, I talked a little bit about at the conference, these are surfaces that get steeper and steeper as you go to smaller and smaller length scales. Almost all the contacts are at zero size or the smallest size in the problem, and so you can get some effect maybe from that. But given the time, I don't want to go off too far in that direction. I want to talk a little bit next about what the role of elastic deformation of the solids would be, because clearly that's an egregious assumption that the things can't deform. It turns out that if you make them a little bit elastic, we showed in the same paper, that actually the friction goes down. We expected that it would allow them to lock together and we would get more friction. We got less. And the reason was that this, when you made for the incommensurate, I think for all cases, but I think the ones we showed were the random, but more, it turns out to be fairly general, because to leading order, you just smooth the surfaces when they become compliant. And so you end up getting a weaker contribution, which was just the opposite of what we expected.
But the magnitude of that effect must depend on the power spectrum of your
yeah, it does, yes.
Blue, not white, yeah, but it's like you were saying, a lot of power short wavelengths.
Well, that's where all the power is always. It's something like 1 over the spacing between the atoms. And so that when you add the elastic deformation, you don't change that too much. But the next thing I wanted to look at was what happens when you're not looking at sort of the small scale, the high frequency response, but the large scale, because we know that there's an awful lot of systems which have this property that even though they're random, so here I never finished writing, that here you get the random force going like area to the minus 1/2, there's a number of systems, including charge density waves and raindrops on window panes and things, where flux lattices and type 2 superconductors, where this nice argument, which says the friction should go to zero, breaks down, because deformations, elastic deformations at large length scales always win. Okay? And so I just want to ask, could that be the explanation of...
So in that list you had raindrops on window panes.
Yes. Yes, I will. It's one of my cases that I'll do. So where does this argument, how does this argument work? The idea, so idea is that we've got some local regions where things want to bunch up a little bit, some other we want to spread out, and over a long length scale we're going to deform the system. And we want to see where do we win. And let me just mention the first, in the context of friction, it was Caroli and Nozier who really did this first, in a book edited by Bo Persson, and Vollmer and Natterman in 97 did a very thorough treatment of this, which is quite nice. And there's been a number of things since. But the basic idea is we imagine let's first look at the case of some d-dimensional object with d-dimensional disorder. So this would be something like the case of a charge density wave. We have a long one-dimensional wire, and there's randomness that is in there. Or in the type 2 superconductor, where the flux lattice is moving through a disordered material. In this case, it turns out what you compare is the energy density to deform on some scale L, and that energy density goes like 1 over L squared. It just goes like Q squared, the wave vector squared, and so the longer the wavelength, the lower the energy density needed to deform the material on that scale. Now, what about the interaction with the random impurities? The energy of interaction with disorder on the same length scale, well, you typically have something like a number of defects that scales like L to the D, but they add incoherently, so you only get a total contribution scaling like the square root of the number of impurities, and you divide by volume to get the energy density, and so you get something that looks like 1 over L to the D over 2, and that's basically the same argument that gave the 1 over square root there. So you can see that for D less than 4, the disorder always wins at large L. If I make L bigger and bigger, this, in say 3 dimensions, will decay less rapidly than that, and so eventually at large length scales I deform the system. Okay? And so this is why charge density waves and flux lattices are pinned. And there's a characteristic length called the Larkin length where you cross over between these behaviors. So now let's take the example of friction. Well, friction, the disorder, is all at the interface between the two surfaces. So we have D dimensions, a D-dimensional elastic object. And a D-dimensional surface, D minus one-dimensional surface, where the disorder lives. Okay, we're sliding some big block like this over the surface, and we're only gaining the energy here. So how does the scaling change? Well, the elastic energy now, we would have a 1 over L squared, but we pick up another factor of L. And if I imagine just a two-dimensional case, if I try to deform the surface locally here, this deformation affects the material in here. And because elasticity has no characteristic length scale, it turns out the depth to which this propagates always is the same as the width. Okay, and so you end up getting this sort of scaling. And the disorder, now, it goes just like 1 over L to the D minus 1 over 2. And that's because it's only in the L to the D minus 1 area of contact that you average up the disorder. So now you see that it's for D less than 3, disorder wins. Well, that means for friction, we're at D equals 3, they scale with the same power. Okay? And so it's not obvious what will win. And So typically what happens is if something is in too weak to deform at small length scales, it stays too weak to deform as you go to larger and larger length scales. There can be exponential corrections. And I think if you have very weak interactions, then you get an exponentially small pinning strength, an exponentially large pinning domain. And basically, you can't explain big friction from this mechanism. Now, where do raindrops on window panes come in?
Sorry, let me ask a question. So, but you go to the marginal case of having a thinner plate, right? In which case you can break your scaling on the elastic.
That's right. So if you have a very thin plate, in principle, you should always get thinning, but because you've dropped to the two-dimensional case. But two-dimensional with two-dimensional disorder. But typically, that's not the limit that one's in. Now, what about raindrops on window panes? Here we have a two-dimensional elastic interface interacting with disorder along a one-dimensional line. Okay? So now we have the case d equal 2. And since that's less than 3, we should always get pinning due to disorder for the case of a fluid interacting with a rough solid. And so this is one of the explanations that explains why raindrops don't slide down the window pane. There's some net force. It deforms. It wins by locking into the local disorder. And then in order to slide down the window, you've got to overcome that force. And so it stays up to some size of the droplet where eventually the weight overwhelms it. And there's some analogies between this raindrop on window pane case and charge density waves and other pinned random systems in terms of their criticality at the onset of motion and things like that. Yeah?
If the drop was made of mercury, which doesn't wet the surface, would it just slide right down then?
Well, mercury also tends to be very heavy, but mercury is one. Right, but so that just changes the length scale. So I'd have to put an L cubed term in for the weight. Okay, so it turns out if you look at real fluids, almost all of them exhibit something called contact angle hysteresis. By equilibrium arguments, they should always hit at a well-defined angle given by the balance of surface energies. And there's normally a range of angles that they're stable over, which corresponds to the pinning. Mercury tends to have one of the smallest amounts of contact angle hysteresis of any fluid, and it is related to the fact that it's so non-wetting. But a typical raindrops or whatever you're drinking in your cup or anything else, you tend to have more contact angle hysteresis.
Has anybody ever done a dynamical problem? Ever watch raindrops racing when you're riding a car?
Yeah, the Faradun family and Paul Meekin played around with some of that and how the drops falling take out lines of drops. They had some simulations maybe 15 to 20 years ago now where they looked at that and the scaling of the sizes and that sort of dynamic process. On which? On the dynamic contact angle, that's a different problem than the dynamics of a lot of collection of drops. Degenne did some work for single defects with Elie Raphael the same time Jean-François Joigny and I did some stuff. And it turns out you couldn't get the mean field exponents for this and stuff out of that. But that's... Anyway... So maybe I've convinced you that it's hard to get friction. Let me turn to a different part of the problem and ask, well, can we figure out what would happen in the sliding state to dissipate energy? And this is probably one of the few cases where we've been able to get a quantitative agreement with experiments. So what we're going to imagine is that we have some substrate which provides a potential. What did I put on here? So I'm going to imagine there's a substrate that's moving at some fixed velocity, and I'm going to have some elastic sheet of molecules that sits on top of that potential. And I want to ask, well, the calculation will work equally well for rubber sheets and sliding over something. I'm going to ask, as this thing slides, how does energy get dissipated? And how do I get a kinetic friction? And I can solve this problem if I assume that there's a linear response. This is, in general, the only case where we can do much exact with dissipation. The fluctuation dissipation theorem holds. And so what we will get is some density wave. So this would be a density modulation. It'll have the wave vector of this underlying potential that's leading to the response. And of course, the response is going to have be at the characteristic frequency, QV, since that's the rate at which it sees the potential changing. And this would just be given by the equilibrium linear response function of the elastic sheet. And in this case, this would be the potential in general. This would be the response to any Fourier component. In this case, we just have U naught delta, well, U naught with omega equal to QV. Now, the way that we can get the kinetic friction is to look at the power dissipated. The power dissipated is just going to be the force we're applying, the kinetic friction, times the velocity, which is the rate of motion. Force times distance will be work. So this is the rate of power dissipation. And this would be the average for the entire film, which, of course, we can get by looking at a time average so an average over time of the local force, which is minus the gradient of our potential. This is the force that this is applying to individual atoms. And this is the current flux. Atoms or mass in the sheet. And we can integrate this by parts using the fact that the rate of change of the density is minus the divergence of the flux and the force is the divergence of the gradient of the energy. So this ends up being just minus the integral over R of the potential with the rate of change of the density. So in the static case, n would be constant, and so this would vanish. During motion, this in general won't be constant, so we can get a net force. And now, if we just okay, so let me give you, this was designed to look at the problem of krypton atoms on gold. And Jackie Krim had done some experiments where she took a metal substrate, which was very rigid compared to everything else, and she put on top of it an adsorbed monolayer, which could be, say, krypton. She's also looked at argon and benzene and some other things, okay? And what she does is she shakes the surface back and forth, and things slip around, and she looks at how much power is being dissipated. Okay, and so I'm looking at the density response of these atoms to the underlying substrate, and in that example, the metal surfaces are so much stiffer than the adsorbed monolayers of gas that the metal can be viewed as rigid. So that was the motivation for this particular idea. Okay.
It's actually photons that are running away from the surface.
No, it's not running away from the surface yet. If I just let me, if I just plug in this expression here, you can see I've got something which looks like the potential, and now n is alpha times the potential. Okay, so I'm just going to pick up something that looks like the potential squared. And I'm going to get an I omega times alpha. Okay, so at the end of the day, I just get area times U naught squared. The QV just comes from the time derivative, which picks up I omega, where omega is QV, and I get the imaginary part of the response function. Now, what do we expect the response function of an elastic sheet to look like? We would expect that there would be some characteristic frequencies where we would have poles, right? But we would expect they wouldn't be perfect poles. There would be some sort of broadening, which would represent the lifetime of the phonon. So just generically, this is the sort of response function that one gets for an elastic membrane. Some sort of normal, some sort of resonant modes and some sort of damping term representing the finite lifetime of the mode. Where this omega naught would be the eigenmode or eigenfrequency at the wave vector Q that we're driving the system at. Okay? So if you put in that sort of form, then the imaginary part is going to give you another factor of omega, which is QV. And unfortunately, since we're running out of time, you end up getting something that just looks like that. And this tells you that the force, the kinetic friction, is proportional to the velocity, because this goes like velocity squared, and I had one factor of the velocity. So I must have a force proportional to velocity, which for a variety of reasons it's convenient to parameterize by a slip time, which is what the experiments on krypton measured, which just picks up all the other factors here. And it turns out that this says the rate at which that rather than having a friction force that looks like this, you have a friction force that's linearly related to the velocity, just like for a fluid. Okay? You have a fluid, you have a viscous dissipation, the velocity gradient gives you a dissipation, and so you end up having force proportional to velocity, which again is not what's seen in experiments. Except in this wonderful case of krypton on gold and xenon on silver, where there's quantitative agreement between the measurements and this type of calculation. There's a little uncertainty as the magnitude of this, but Jackie Krim has recently looked at four systems where this is known and shown that this goes like the square of U-naught, and I think this is coming out in PRL or has recently come out. So, so far we have a lot of... The other thing this can quantitatively explain, it turns out, is that with krypton, you get more friction when the monolayer is a liquid than when it's a crystal. Okay? Now that sort of seems bizarre. You freeze this layer and instead of getting solid friction, you get sliding that's easier. That's because it's incommensurate and the crystal is stiffer, which makes this thing smaller, which makes the friction go down. So this argument... Oh, so what's happening? Where is the energy going? Getting back to your question, Jay. What happens is, as you drag this, there's a sort of frozen phonon trying to move backwards to the film. That's not an ideal eigenmode. There's some sort of coupling to the other phonons if there's any anharmonicity in the system. And so some energy leaks out into the other modes. And you can show that that this stuff scales as the amount of energy in this frozen mode that's trying to propagate back through the film. And so you're leaking energy out at a rate that's proportional to that energy that's stored and multiplied by 1 over the phonon lifetime, the rate at which coupling things would couple out to other phonon modes. And it just gets spread within all the other modes in the film, and then it's heat. Now, the I think I've pretty much run out of time without getting to my last thing. But in the interest of... Yes, well... Yes, yeah. It turns out that you must have something which is not in linear response. And there's a model called the Tomlinson model where if you have, again, a periodic potential and you have a spring, then if the spring is weak enough, you can get hung up back in this minimum as this end moves away. And when it finally moves, it pops suddenly. And that motion, because it's linearly unstable, so if this is U-naught and we have the wave vector Q, when Q squared U-naught over K is bigger than 1, you get linear instability and you get rapid pops, which can dissipate a whole lot more energy than this simple, quiet motion. Okay, and it turns out that this is this model actually maps to the mean field model of charge density wave conductors that that Daniel Fisher first looked at. And it has all the same behavior, but Prantl and Tomlinson looked at it around 1900 for friction. So you have to have these random pops, and these rapid pops give you energy dissipation even in the limit of zero velocity. And the force versus velocity, for this case, ends up looking generically like this. There's an initial power law of two-thirds looking this way, and then some final behavior that depends upon how you assume the energy is eventually dissipated. And the static friction is just a little bigger than the kinetic friction. Now, so this helps to explain things. The problem is that it assumes, well, in order for this to happen, it turns out this needs to be much bigger than this. Now, this turns out to be related to the internal stiffness of the solid. This is an interaction across the interface, and normally you don't expect the interaction between the two solids to be stronger than the internal. It turns out it's actually even worse. This one's related to longitudinal, and this is related to the shear mode. And so even if you take graphite, crystals on graphite, which has been done recently, so the interactions are the same, but you rotate the graphite layer on top so it's incommensurate, you get no measurable friction between the two surfaces. Okay? So this kind of elastic instability just doesn't happen in 99.9% of the cases. So you need something else, and that something else could be, in many cases, something between the two surfaces that's weakly bound to both. Okay? So everything around us is covered with crud. And if you look in Feynman's book, he points this out, that when you measure the friction of copper on copper, you're really measuring the friction of copper with junk on it on copper with other junk on it. And experimentalists know that touching things can change stuff. And so if we imagine that we have some molecules like hydrocarbons that are absorbed on the surfaces, these would have weak springs coupling them because basically there's nothing holding them together. They just came out of the air, right? If they had strong interactions, they wouldn't have been flying around there in the first place. So these things interact weakly, so there's a weak spring effectively compared to the potential that they sit in. And now these things can pop they will first move to find places where they're locally happy, and then even if these surfaces are incommensurate, they will, once they're happy, they won't want the stop surface to slide, ruining their nice little hiding spots. And when you finally move one surface enough that a local site becomes unstable, it pops in just the way shown here, and you get a lot of dissipation, and you can show that 80 or 90% of the energy gets dissipated. This model also lets you look at the effect of temperature and how you can get log V type dependence in the kinetic friction due to thermally activated hopping. Okay, so I'm sorry that the end got so truncated, but in order to, something must be being deformed in a very nonlinear manner in order to see what we're seeing. And one way is to have very weak things that are easy to push around. The other, as Nadia mentioned at the beginning, is to have such big forces within the contact that everything's just deforming plastically, even the subsurface. And that also happens in some cases, and there's a debate about, you know, how frequently. Most statements about friction cannot be made universally. That's a universal statement.
So. Examples, because you seem to be qualifying this dissipation through plastic work.
Yes.
As something rare. Tires wear out, ball bearings wear out, almost all technological applications of friction, we see permanent structural radiation on the surface.
Oh, sure, sure. And so the question is then, where it's at the moment in terms of most friction research, because that's really what people would like to do, is to lower wear.
Right.
Now we can ask how much of the energy dissipated, how much of this FKV is due to the wear itself. And as Bowden and Tabor pointed out, and they were the ones who originally talked about having plastic deformation, giving a growth in contact area, etc., the amount of wear you would need in something like a ball bearing, okay, to get this dissipation is many, many orders of magnitude too big. When you first start the ball bearing moving, there may be some of this plastic deformation. They call this run-in, and the friction is frequently higher. But in the steady state operation of many things, it seems like the peaks have gotten smoothed off to some degree, and you can't really attribute the amount of work you're doing to plastic deformation. It certainly goes into heat, and as I said, this coupling to all the other phonons effectively is creating heat. Heat is just work you can't get back out, or energy you can't get back out. And so, yeah?
It seems to me that plastic flow is also one of the ways when you take two non-commensurate surfaces and you make them commensurate over an aspherical size. Right? So your surfaces behave the way, if you put them, somehow friction comes from interlocking of some kind of asperities, right? But if I take any what's called, you know, nominally flat but microscopically rough surfaces, put them in contact and then apply these classical theories of, you know, some asperities plastically, you know, some contacts plastically flowing and forming, you know, a flat asperities, then over that, if you can imagine something like almost an atomic contact, then they would be much more commensurate on that scale, and that's where the friction would come from.
Turns out, no. If I have two different solids, right, and I push them together, each in general is going to have their own lattice constant. And so there's no reason why in the contact they will be commensurate. That's not their equilibrium state. Now, if the forces across the interface are big enough, they may try their best to lock together. But if you have two crystals of different materials, in general, there's no way of creating a plane where things are locally commensurate. In fact, Binchuan has done some simulations where you take a rigid crystal and you push another one up into it, and plasticity lowers friction because you get bigger contacts. The bigger contacts are incommensurate, and so you get more averaging away to zero. So plasticity is not enough to guarantee locking at the interface. And we've got other cases where you have amorphous solids, which maybe are more flexible than crystals and can somehow find ways of under plastic deformation, accommodating. But crystals are not very good at accommodating another period. So most of the people who have these plastic models, the idea of plastic deformation of surfaces goes a long way back, but no one ever talks about what's happening at the interface after the plastic deformation in any of these classical theories. They just say, well, obviously there's friction there, but that's not enough.
Okay, that's fine.